It's time now for All You Ever Wanted to Know, a chance for you to get to know what's going on in and around your community and the fabulous people that make it happen. With On the Land, here's Jack Dawes.
Well, once again, good morning for a Thursday morning. A bit of an update today from the Water Stewardship, or at least from the Water Security Agency, regarding spring runoff. Looks like the southeast corner could be an area of concern. Of course, a lot can change between now and actual runoff. We'll get to that story. The expression, everything old is new again. What about spreading nutrients on the surface? Turns out that it's becoming a more economical and more environmentally friendly type of an activity. We spent a day learning more about nutrition, plant nutrition, yesterday here at the new John Deere building, the Maple Farm Equipment, Pattison Agriculture Building here in Yorkton. Now, Harry Siemens is joining us this morning, as he often does, from southern Manitoba. He's got an update on the story about TPP. Is it dead or not, the Trans-Pacific Partnership? Harry also has an update on the pulse market looks in India right now as well. Well, most of the province received below normal rain snowfall, resulting in a below normal runoff potential across most of Saskatchewan. So says a bulletin today from the Water Security Agency. The snowpack almost completely melted or was lost in January with those above normal temperatures. Hard to remember those this week. The melting snowpack would have saturated the soil surface, the agency says, and that reduces the infiltration capacity for the melt of any late season snow. Southeast Saskatchewan is the exception. It's near normal, increasing to well above normal in the extreme southeast corner of the province. Above normal runoff now is expected in the lower Souris River Basin below Rafferty and Alameda Dams, including the Antler River, Gainsborough Creek, and Lightning Creek Basins. Of course, again, this is a preliminary outlook, and the snow plaque, as we know, could... does that mean you get bad breath? The snowpack could change quite a bit between now and mid or the end of March. Well, is everything old and new again? It could be. In the case of nutrient management, about 75 farmers and industry people checked in yesterday at the new information theater, part of the recently opened Maple Farm Equipment Complex on Yorkton's west side, now part of the Pattison Agriculture Group. For this reporter, at least, a new generation of thinking about nutrient application, including the latest and massive John Deere fertilizer spreader, 330 cubic feet carry capacity, powered by 360 plus horsepower, capable of spinner spreading 165 to 205 acres an hour, we understand. It's 27,000 pounds, can boogie right along. Now, our machinery tour guide, one of the Maple Farm Equipment guys, Rob Reitz.
46 mile an hour road speed.
46, yep.
Yeah. Auto steer up to 25 miles an hour in the field. So fast ground speeds while you're spreading. Very smooth ride. We did drive this one. I went down to Orlando, Florida, and I did get to drive this one versus the yellow one, and much smoother ride, much smoother controls, not as jerky. That IVT transmission, no gears to shift. It's nice and smooth, very smooth. It's just forward and back like a hydrostatic drive. Very nice.
Rob Reitz again with the Pattison Agriculture Group. Farmers, of course, had much more insightful questions than I.
This is a density scale for the product to get the density of the product. And we have our little crush gauge that measures the hardness of the kernel of the product. You take a kernel and you put it on the table and you push down on this, and it measures how much pressure it takes to crush that kernel. And then this little guy here is a...
And so what does that tell me?
So it tells us the RPM that we can run the spinner. It tells us how far we can spread it, because if it's a real soft kernel, if we have the spinner turning too fast, when the spinner falls off the conveyor belt and down into the spinner, it crushes that kernel and turns it into powder. Well, how far can you throw powder, right?
Yeah, okay.
But if it's still a solid kernel, we can actually fling it a lot further. So we keep our RPM down and we can get a wider spread pattern. And then we have this little guy here, so we also need to know what size our kernel is, so it's just a little screen inside there, so we put our product inside. inside there, and we shake it down, and we'll find out what basic size our kernel is. And that, again, there'll be charts that tell us what we can use for spinner speed and what we can expect for a spread pattern out of that.
Is that a new? Or?
These have been around
this
for a while.
Around, yeah.
Yep. And then the other thing that we would get with the unit is we take a 100-foot rope and we put a mark on the rope every 1 foot, and then we take a 1-foot square catch pan, a little Tupperware tub, and inside the tub we'll have a little crosshatch plastic piece so the seeds can't bounce out of there. And we lay that out and we make a pass across that, and then we actually collect all the product that's caught in these 1-foot square pans, and we dump it into a little vial, and we actually see how even the spread pattern is and how far we're getting out from the spread pattern across the width, so we see how accurate our spreader is functioning.
So that again, Rob Reitz. Rob Reitz, our tour guide at the John Deere site here in Yorkton. By the way, retail on that rather large unit would run about $450,000. Now, of course, one of the major challenges in broadcast applying ammonia fertilizer is managing the losses. So later in the day, we heard from Cook Fertilizer Canada's sales manager, Tom Berry, to explain the fit for this type of machine.
So is the bottom line is, if you're applying ammonia-type fertilizers, you either deep band it or you broadcast it. Is that the best choices?
The best way to manage nitrogen loss is to deep band. Unfortunately, in the last 30 years, farmers have got bigger, equipment's got bigger, and it's not possible from a draft requirements, fuel, and wear and tear perspective. So what's happened is growers have started putting their nitrogen shallower, which doesn't have the same loss minimization as putting nitrogen deep. So what a lot of growers are doing is, instead of putting it deep, is that they are either taking it out of the air tank completely and they're stabilizing it with a urease enzyme inhibitor called agritane, or with Super U fertilizer, which has a urease enzyme inhibitor and a nitrification inhibitor in it, which takes a bad agronomic practice of broadcasting and makes it acceptable because the losses are minimized by using these products.
I think you said we had the worst year for fertilizer sales. Was that your point?
We had a very rough fall across Western Canada with a lot of crops still remaining out. Western Canada typically gets a pretty good chunk of anhydrous ammonia down in the fall, and because of the poor weather and amount of crop left out, anhydrous ammonia didn't go down at typical 10-year average levels that we typically see. So that will put some constraints on in the spring for farmers that use anhydrous ammonia, because logistics will be very tight around these products.
And what do you see for this coming spring?
It will be a very busy spring. There's a lot of crop to take off in certain areas across Western Canada. There's a lot of fields where farmers fought to get the crop off, and there's a lot of ruts to fix. So we could see a delayed start, or we could, you never know. In April, we can have the snow go and everybody get into the field. So we'll see. But as always, every spring in Western Canada, farmers seed their crops faster and faster and faster. So as always, it will be a... it would be very busy.
So the delivery window gets tighter?
Indeed. It's tighter every year to move the fertilizer to farm and get the fertilizer on the fields.
This morning the farmers looked at a big new unit that John Deere here has, a spreader, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That looks like a pretty good time for them to introduce this kind of a product.
Yeah, as we're seeing across Western Canada, the advent of farmers moving back to broadcasting and using stabilized forms of nitrogen like agritane, nitrogen stabilizer, or Super U fertilizer, it's allowing farmers to broadcast, and that allows them to take bulky urea-based fertilizers out of their air tanks, and in turn it allows them to fill those air tanks less often during the day and allows them to seed more acres in a day.
It's a pretty timely introduction.
Yeah, a very timely introduction for John Deere to be launching their new self-propelled spreader. A lot of farmers are looking at things like spreaders, and especially the John Deere one here today, to speed up their operations. And so, yeah, you're absolutely correct. It's a prime time for the launch.
You addressed some of the environmental concerns around fertilizer use.
Nitrogen fertilizer, when it's manufactured, requires a tremendous amount of energy, and a lot of that energy comes from natural gas. So when we make fertilizer, we use a lot of natural gas as manufacturers, and as farmers, from a environmental perspective or carbon footprint, the largest carbon footprint on their farm is nitrogen-based fertilizer in turn.
So obviously we want to become more and more efficient using it.
Exactly. The whole point of fertilizing your crop is we don't want to be putting excess fertilizer down. We want to be maximizing the amount and rates, the right time, the right placement, the right rates of fertilizer to grow the crops we need. And we don't want to be using any more than we need to be because it's not environmentally responsible and it doesn't make economic sense.
That again, Tom Berry with Cook Fertilizer, speaking yesterday, one of the presenters at a seminar on nutrient management here in Yorkton. Tom Berry, by the way, originally a farm boy from Nipawin, Aylsham area. Now, a little later in the program, more from Jack's excellent adventures in fertilizer application and John Deere land. We're going to check in now with Harry Siemens. Harry, as always, has a couple of interesting pieces for us. Good morning, Mr. Siemens.
Good morning. Just one observation. I was listening to the newscast for the national news, and it was about Emerson, which is just like 25 minutes away from me, where they're walking across the border, Jack.
Yes, so I hear.
And you know what? It's
Who
not
wouldn't?
The only time. My friend Howard Friesen was combining last fall, and all of a sudden there was a Somalian walking right in front of his combine at 11:30 in the morning, or in the evening.
Well,
but it's quite a thing going on. But right now, I want to talk about TPP. Jerry Ritz and I follow each other on Twitter, and I tweeted something, and he says, no. He says, TPP isn't dead. Well, I said, put your money where your mouth is. He called me up within a few minutes, and here is our short conversation about why he thinks TPP isn't dead.
Tell me. You tell me on Twitter.
Yeah.
TPP isn't dead.
No, not at all. Never has been. It's never even been on life support. The point being, when President Trump and both he and Clinton campaigned on not signing on to TPP, so I started making the rounds almost a year ago to the other 10 ambassadors from all of the other countries and trade ministers that I've gotten over the years, saying, okay, what's stopping us from going forward without the U.S.? And they all agreed that we should. So this work has been going on. I know Japan is, you know, instrumental in this, that they've actually, they're the first country to pass it through their legislature. They're ready to go. They need a dance partner, and nobody's quite done that yet. But there is a meeting coming up in Chile, middle of March, just talking about moving forward without the U.S. This whole excuse that we couldn't do it because there's a clause that says 85% with six countries goes out the window, because that can be rewritten by the willing partners. Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Mexico, Chile, Peru, all are ready to move forward. Malaysia and Brunei is as well. Malaysia and Venezuela are being courted very strongly by China, trying to draw them into their multilateral agreement. But at the end of the day, all of these other countries want to move forward. They see this as the right move. They see putting, and the Japanese have said too, that this will put pressure on Trump to reassess his first thoughts of just no TPP at all. They're more interested in doing the multilateral deal than they are with the bilat with Canada, which is good news, because we would never receive the same ambitious access that we do under the multilateral agreement in a bilat with Japan.
What about Canada?
Well, that's a good question. What about Canada? We've been studying this thing. We've been doing cross-Canada tours. We're working on a report. They seem to be stalling rather than embracing the ideology. If we're going to face an uphill fight on NAFTA, the smartest move we can make is endorse the TPP, get that ratified, and use that as a bit of a club in our negotiations with the U.S. Completion of the CETA agreement and TPP agreement, moving forward with the ASEAN group of countries, even going as far as China after we have everything else done, would keep the NAFTA arguments a little more slided our way, because we've got other alternatives.
Well, they just made their trip rounds in Washington, I see, yesterday.
Well, there's different ways to make that trip in Washington. Certainly you have to meet at the higher levels. But at the end of the day, if you're going to have any kind of strength on the ground with the Trump administration on NAFTA, you have to do like we did on country of origin labeling and get state-level pressure and industry pressure on the administration in Washington to make sure that it doesn't go too far one way.
And some interesting comments, as far as I'm concerned, that it isn't dead and that we can still work at it.
So, that's an interesting story. And I guess we should mention in passing, I'm sure most agriculture people will know that Jerry Ritz is the former Canadian agriculture minister and obviously still working the agriculture beat. So, Harry, you've also been looking into the pulse situation, what the market might be like in India?
Well, G. Chandra Shekhar, I got to know him way back when, but he's been speaking at various crop programs and seminars in Saskatchewan. I contacted him again just a few days ago. He's going to be speaking at the Outlook Conference for the United States of America in Arlington, Virginia in the last week of February. Then in July, he's going to speak at the Canadian Special Crops meeting in Vancouver. So he does get around. He's a journalist for 20 years for the Hindu Business Times, and he's also a consultant for the government. So we talked about a number of things, and here, let's roll that conversation.
Is the demand for pulses in India expanding?
Oh, certainly. Pulses are, of course, a very small part of India's agricultural landscape. India is actually the world's largest producer of milk. It is the second largest producer of rice and wheat and cotton and sugar and fruits and vegetables. But whereas pulses, of course, we are the largest in pulses, but in terms of output, pulses account for only 21 or 22 million tons. Whereas we produce more than 90 million tons of wheat, more than 100 million tons of rice, more than 25, 26 million tons of sugar, a big number, 300 million tons of fresh fruits and vegetables. I think those are real big tickets. We discuss pulses because of the strong relationship between Canada and India. And Canada is the largest supplier of pulses.
What do you see for the 2017 crop? I mean, we... in Manitoba, they just a big company just announced a pea processing plant at Portage la Prairie.
Oh, okay, wonderful, wonderful.
Yeah, and we're looking at there's a group that's looking at trying to attract money to build a world class soybean processing plant in Manitoba.
Oh, lovely, wonderful, wonderful.
Because people are seeing soybeans in the next 5 to 7 years, Saskatchewan may be increasing to 5 million acres, and in Manitoba this year already we're looking at over 2 million.
Lovely, yes, I know Canada is rapidly expanding its soybean acreage, obviously inspired by the happenings in the U.S., which is important. After all, soybean is an important animal feed, important protein. So great, I think that'll be wonderful. I think at some stage, probably Canadian soybean will catch up with Canadian canola.
That's what I have said for a number of years. When canola came on the scene and blossomed so quickly, we called it the Cinderella crop, right?
Yeah.
And I think soybeans could be even, very quickly the same.
Very true.
What about the economy? I mean, the media, we hear so much about what has happened in India, where your president, did something with the currency and so forth. Has that been straightened out, or how is that going?
Yes, it's called demonetization. High-value currency notes of 1,000 rupees and 500 rupees. These two high denomination notes accounted for over 70% of the total currency in circulation. And because people hold it, kept under the pillow and under the bed, huge piles of cash which was unaccounted, the Prime Minister of the country took an extremely courageous decision to demonetize and denotify these high-value currencies, and that created a huge amount of disturbance in the system. but it required extraordinary political courage for him to do this. He did it. I think he sailed through reasonably well, notwithstanding huge amount of political backlash. But I think it's all now sorted out, in the sense there is no cash crunch. And a huge amount of money has come into the banking system. People with hoards of cash have deposited all the money in their bank account. They will pay tax on it. Therefore, government's revenue will go up. Therefore, there has been a lot of spin-off benefits of this demonetization.
So then those people who were hoarding those big bills, they had some time to deposit it in the bank and get value for it?
Yes, they had a few days' time. They had, I think, about 50 days to deposit, which expired on the 30th of December. So it's a very, very substantial part of the hoarded cash has actually now come into the banking system. And on this, whoever deposited these monies in their accounts will have to pay tax on it, and then their accounts will be regularized, which means the government is going to collect a huge pile of revenue from these unaccounted cash.
Okay.
And in future, a large part of the transactions will all be banking transactions, non-cash transactions.
Just one other observation. He told me that despite the media reports of all kinds of things happening, he said there wasn't one demonstration, no protests. People actually did what they had to do. And he says the president, Modi, he says he's a single fella. He doesn't need the money. And the people believe him because he's honest. So he took this gamble, and it certainly seems to have at least worked in the short term.
Harry, by the way, just let our listeners know it's on the land from the Rock 98.5. Harry Siemens in Winkler, Manitoba, regular contributor and cooperator on this program. Our producer today, Jordan Patswold, Harry, had a thought about that currency.
Well, it's just so fascinating, Harry, because he mentions the high value of those bills, and it was pretty shocking. I recall this story coming out a couple months back, and people likely may make the assumption that, oh, these bills, they might be worth the equivalent of, say, you know, a $100 bill or a $200 bill. And actually, the rupee, by comparison's sake, isn't really all that much. There's 50 rupees to one Canadian dollar, ultimately. So it's quite staggering to think what would happen here in Canada if all of the 10 and $20 bills were taken out of circulation. That is the equivalent of what has happened there in India. Now, granted, 10 and $20, if you will certainly get you a lot farther in India than other countries.
Yeah, and they basically shut down the ATM machines, or at least didn't have those bills there. So there was no choice. I mean, they had to empty pillows and mattresses and get that money into the system.
Yeah, that's just it. I know it was part also tied to counterfeit as well, those bills being highly circulated illegally and trafficked and whatnot. But certainly, sometimes the economy very much depends on money being in the system and people not acting afraid, as it were.
Well, Harry Siemens, I heard there's so much money under your mattress that you slipped off there.
Well, they used to say that when Elvis Presley was still alive, he broke his leg, and they said, well, how come? He fell off his wallet.
All right. Well, Harry, two great pieces of audio there. We appreciate it. I think you have some other broadcast duties today, so we thank you, for as always, for your contribution.
Good. Thank you very much, and good day.
Good day. Harry Siemens, our cooperator in Winkler, Manitoba. Well, the Western Canadian wheat growers are out with comment today on the international trade front, you might say. They say, you know, we've often heard about Canadian truckers or Canadian farmers taking wheat or other produce to the United States. The wheat growers say that their counterparts in the USA aren't being given equal treatment here in Canada. That story had as well. Oats was suggested as a trade irritant being used between Europe and the United States. We have those stories for you as well. How about a situation where food waste off tables and restaurants and whatnot in Calgary, ending up as fertilizer here in the prairies. That's a second part of our lead story today about nutrient management seminar we attended here in Yorkton yesterday. It's On the Land from The Rock, 98.5.
Don't wait! Get your big four-wheel drive tractor ready for spring. Take advantage of Value Tire's special winter rate. Save on labor until the end of February on your new tractor tires. Value Tire's got it. A huge selection of sizes and brands. The ever-popular Petless, Michelin, Galaxy, and Dynamo tractor tires. Avoid disappointment. Book early. Petless tires are like hotcakes. They're going fast. Value Tire, Highway 10 East Yorkton. Yorkton's largest selection of tires.
Is now the time? I'm Glenn Seward. If you've heard our Today's Great Idea stories here on The Rock 98.5, brought to you by the Key Auto Group, you know every great business or invention was started by someone just like you, who took action and overcame some hurdles. What you may not know is at todaysgreatidea.com, we help people with great ideas craft compelling business plans, build smart investor pitch decks, and tell their story really well. It's what we do. Find us today at todaysgreatidea.com, and let's get started.
The Rock Business Guide, featuring these rock-solid businesses.
This is David Disty of Disty Counseling Services. I'm passionate about building relationships as God desires to see them. Looking through the scriptures, we see numerous examples of relationships, both ones that worked and ones that didn't. We also see principles of sound relationships in how God deals with us. Using these principles and examples, I strive to help others develop their relationships into what God wants for us. If you want to grow your relationships, call David Disty at 316-0101.
This is Jeff from Everlast Eaves and Exteriors. Are you tired of watching your heating budget dollars fly out those drafty windows? You'll enjoy winter energy savings and comfort with your new high-performance PVC windows from Everlast Eaves and Exteriors. Premium renovators and premium quality windows is what you'll find at Everlast Eaves and Exteriors. Call us at 786-7055.
The Rock Business Guide, featuring these rock-solid businesses.
Please.
Moms can't quite fix everything. With the real bumps and bruises, Dunright Auto Body and Painting has you covered. Their SGI-accredited repair shop takes pride in a job well done. From fiberglass work to auto painting, glass installation to collision work, they'll transform your ride inside and out. Insurance claims are welcome. Stop by for a free estimate. Dunright Auto Body and Painting, 391 Ball Road, Yorkton.
You won the bunch for lunch.
Really? I never win anything.
Everyone can be a winner. Call in during our all-request lunch at noon from Monday to Friday and get entered to win a bouquet of flowers from Growers Direct, plus a certificate to West Broadway Grill. No open late. What are you waiting for? Call in today. Bunch for Lunch, only from The Rock 98.5. You're listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you have a question for today's guest, call 783-5160 or 1-855-449-5160.
We talked off the top of the program about nutrient management, if you think about a family farm operation in eastern Saskatchewan, such as Langenberg, and then think about a major effort recycling food waste in Calgary, but then think again about that waste product being turned into fertilizer and being applied to farmland right back here in east central Saskatchewan. All right, just start out by giving us your name, rank, and your official title here today.
Wow, my rank is kind of interesting. No, my name is Dan Eberhardt, and I'm president of Eberhardt Ag Solutions, which is a company that was formed in 2015 solely to bring Biosol to the market in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. And I'm partners along with my brother, Terry, and my father, Harvey, who also farm at Langeberg, and my brother's an agronomist with a significant consulting business.
So where's headquarters? For Biosol?
Technically, the headquarters for Biosol would be in Alberta with the mothership, the manufacturing company called BioCycle Solutions. And we are the distribution arm in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. And the product originates right now, I would say 80% of the product originates out of Strathmore, Alberta, is sort of the heart of the system.
Right. So the basic idea is you you recycle, well, virtually everything.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are master recyclers in the best sense of the world. I mean, you can have a green bin.
Yeah.
Does that mean what you're doing is actually sustainable for the environment, as we all like to be? Not necessarily. We are solving a number of real-world issues, probably the biggest one of which is food waste.
Food waste.
And the quality and the quantity of food that is being thrown out on a mass scale out of urban centers today is shocking. Those that go and see the actual facility where we're removing the organic goo, which gets composted from the packaging, come back with a new sense of just how big this problem is. And it's not only that, we're taking away a whole bunch of different kinds of waste that would normally go to landfill, and elemental sulfur, which is also a landfill product. So as Elston so aptly put it, you could consider that we're turning, in a very positive sense, don't take this the wrong way, but in a very positive sense, we're turning every acre of farmland that we apply biosol on into a landfill and replacing that. And you're going to see a trend towards reduction or absolutely outlawing of organic material going to landfills for good reason, because it just goes there and rots and creates the bad methane gases everybody's so concerned with these days, and we're making it back into fertilizer.
Now, you have machinery, you have the ability to depackage. Am I is that the way to put it?
That's one of the unique things that they're doing, is that they're separating those components. So it's a service that's provided to the grocers that are involved. They're having the right size bins at the back of their facilities, and they take this waste away, and the grocers don't have to worry about it, you know, being out of the packaging or any other inconvenience like that. It gets taken to a facility where everything's properly aerated and safety is a, you know, major concern, and they put it onto this tipping floor, and then it gets loaded into sort of first stage of separation and conveyor, up into the depackaging machine, which then through a series of, you know, centrifuges and hammer mills and augers gently removes the stuff that we want to compost from the packaging, which gets recycled in itself.
And this is at Strathmore?
This is at our facility in Calgary.
Oh, in Calgary.
The physical pad where they combine the finished compost and the sulfur is at Strathmore. And they have other pads in Alberta, and of course they're working on production in Saskatchewan and hopefully eventually Manitoba and eventually the world.
Hmm. So if I'm understanding correctly, so this compost is then combined with elemental sulfur?
Yeah, and the key to the reason that we combine the finished compost with the elemental sulfur is that it reduces the dusting normally associated with elemental sulfur. It reduces the risk of fire normally associated with elemental sulfur. And it introduces an element of this biological activity, which converts the elemental sulfur in the soil. So it's doing a lot of great things for us in a really cost-efficient manner. It's Mother Nature's little helpers are coming to work for us for a very reasonable rate. And
microbes,
yeah. We haven't exactly identified the species and the mode of action that are in the compost in terms of what they do for the elemental sulfur, but there's a whole set of species that convert the elemental sulfur once it's on the soil, i.e. Thiobacillus, converting it to sulfate, a form the plants can use. But we've already got the head start, if you will, the kick-starting of the microbial activity with the compost, which is a beautiful thing.
Mm. Now, there are people in this area, 500 miles from Calgary, that are applying the end result. So obviously the transportation logistics don't overcome the benefits of the processing, I guess is what I'm getting at.
Thankfully, that does not, overcome the net benefit to producers. One of the lowest costs per pound of sulfur on the market, even in Manitoba. So logistics is a huge challenge. This product can only be handled with things like live bottoms, conveyors, Super B side dumps, Super B end dumps, spin spreaders. It handles like an aggregate. It doesn't go through hopper bottom bins. It doesn't go through air seeders or augers. But that is a big reason that we've set up a very capable network of individual businesses that handle the product with the specialized equipment. We call them trusted applicators. So they're certified and they're big into safety, and they've got all the insurance and know how to handle the product. And they've got all the proper calibrated equipment. required to put this stuff on. And if farmers want to put it on themselves, they need to have certain equipment to do it, modern equipment.
So one of your side dump units will deliver it to the farm, and then the farmer handles it from there, presumably.
One of the really neat things about this product is one of the only macronutrients that's delivered direct to farm. That's sort of outside of the matrix of the normal fertilizer distribution network of the big companies that are really prevalent in the market today. We can send product direct to a farm. It stores much like lime. It stores outside. The sulfur itself is hydrophobic, sheds the water, so it's a variable product. We can store it outside on the ground, and the advantage is that we don't need bins, and we can use telehandlers to pick it up and put it in our spin spreader and put it on the surface of the soil. We want to broadcast it on top and let it amortize and gently release into the soil surface, and it's kind of simple, really.
So I know there were some charts shown here today, but roughly how much per pound or how much per acre? Can you give me a benchmark applied in this part of Saskatchewan?
Absolutely. So here in this part of the world, it's $275 a ton right now, and the analysis is 70% actual S. And you can equate that a number of different ways, $27.50 an acre, because we do 10 acres per ton, or about 18 cents per pound. So if you take a look at other sources of manufactured fertilizer for sulfate on the market or other sources of sulfur, you're probably going to look at double that or triple that or quadruple that for most sources. And the application and tendering is $12, so that puts you close to $40, but that'll give you a 4 or 5 year supply of sulfur, over 150 pounds of actual S that more than most producers are putting down in a longer than 5 years life cycle, and they're getting the benefit of that sulfur availability throughout all their cropping rotation.
As far as application, so now today it just so happens we're at a John Deere location where they've unveiled, or farmers got to kick tires on a spreader of this product?
One of the exciting things about this product is that it cash flows a new piece of iron on the farm for a producer that can change the way that he farms. And whether you're looking at a pull type for $150 or $200,000, very sophisticated piece of application equipment, or something like this self-propel spreader, once you have that on the farm, there's all kinds of other things that become possible in terms of spreading, making your seeding more efficient, handling your logistics, amortizing the cost of equipment and men. That's a very exciting part of this. When guys realize with the cost per pound of this nutrient that it actually helps cash flow long term, some iron, it's going to change the way they farm. I think that's a huge advantage.
So Elston Salzberg, who just spoke here, an agronomist, made the prediction that the day will come when most viable farms will be using spin spreaders again.
Well, sometimes Elston's claims are somewhat outlandish and hard to believe. But the reality is that I've seen it.
Yeah.
I've lived through it. I started selling sprayers in 2000 until 2013. And when I started selling sprayers in 2000, I was literally brought on to sell just the commercials, the input retailers.
Yeah.
I didn't know that I would ever sell a sprayer to a farmer. Now, everyone has one. And I see the spin spreader following much the same curve. So it's a lot of fun for me to be involved with, because we started trying to move the needle on the spin spreaders in 2005. But it was too early. And here we are, starting to come around. Mm-hmm. And biosols being a big part of that, I think.
There's a lot more to the story I'd like to ask you about, but what about the barbecue sauce now? Is that part of your deal?
Well, that's kind of a secret sauce that we've been using just to promote interaction and just market what we're doing. But the fact is, we have a secret sauce.
Do you manufacture it?
No, we don't manufacture it, but it's a lot of fun just to tell people that we do, and that we, of course, incorporate compost into it, because they kind of look at you sideways for a couple seconds, and then there's some laughter, but the fact is it's really good. We have a hickory flavor and a honey garlic flavor so far, and I'm sure there'll be more flavors to come, but people really enjoy our barbecue sauce.
Great. That again, Dan Eberhardt of Eberhardt Ag Solutions. Dan actually lives in Brandon, and the business we talked about, by the way, does have at least one local distributor that we know of for the recycled fertilizer project, if you will. That's Glenn Helgeson at Foam Lake. Glenn and a number of his people were also at the seminar yesterday. So, again, the context for that interview with Dan Eberhardt was a nutrition management seminar at the Pattison Agriculture new facility just west of the city of Yorkton. As you heard, the discussion with the composted material, they add elemental sulfur, another product, of course, which is plentiful. Which is plentiful in a petroleum-producing province like Alberta and, of course, Saskatchewan the same. So the job for well-known agronomist Elton Salzberg that we mentioned in that interview was to fit all the pieces together, including where does a spinner-type present-day fertilizer spreader fit. He reminds us to keep the big picture in mind.
Nitrogen doesn't fit. Broadcasting nitrogen doesn't fit. So there's everything from molybdenum and nickel, which are required in the lowest amounts, to things like carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen that are required in the highest amounts. And so the challenge for us as we grow forward is not just to focus in on nitrogen and NPKs, it's to focus in on all of this stuff and get a better understanding of how it all fits together and get a better understanding of how the plant, when the plant needs it, how the plant utilizes it, et cetera, et cetera. And the reality, again, folks, is that when you go to those high-yield environments, and this is a high-yield environment for Western Canada, this part of the world is a high-yield environment, every pass over the field has got nutrients in the tank. And, of course, there's some guys in this room that are doing that. But as an average, the industry is very much confused about the whole thing. And so today is a lot more about than about the four R's. It's about the balance of all of this stuff. All of this stuff. The beauty, and I firmly believe this, and I've believed this for a long time, is that every farm of consequence within the next 5 to 10 years will have a big spin spreader. Because there are very few things we do in agriculture where a logistical decision becomes a good agronomic decision. We do a lot of logistical things that suck agronomically. We do. Spin spreader is one of those things that allows a very great logistical decision to become an awesome agronomic decision. And Dan Eberhardt just talked about Biosol, which is one of those things. You know, crops need sulfur every year. We focus as an industry, and I know there's exceptions in here because I know some of you guys, but a lot of the industry doesn't apply sulfur to crops every year. They only apply it to their canola crop. But every crop needs sulfur every year. And so logistically, you phone up, the lady was asking the question, how do you get the sulfur to your farm? You phone somebody up, and they worry about the trucking and the application, and then you don't have to worry about sulfur for 4, 5, 6 years. How much simpler can it get? Logistically simple, agronomically brilliant. How much easier can it get? And there's what I know is that once a person starts playing around with something like Biosol, then they're going to start thinking, well, what else can I do with this piece of equipment? And there's all kinds of things that people do. Do you know that in the Mid-South and the Midwest, farmers variable rate phosphorus and potassium a lot? But guess how they do it? They do it through a spin spreader.
And they do it... September, too.
Sorry?
In the month of September.
Exactly. And they do it based on last year's crop removal, based off of a yield map. Now, agronomically, most scientists in Western Canada would say, what are you guys smoking? Right? Because when you broadcast phosphorus or potassium, you immediately reduce the short-term availability of it, right? But what they're focused in on is not next year. They're focused in on, you know, how that nutrient is going to release over a period of years. And so the concept of using something like Biosol or high rates of Keg River or Tiger 90 is very similar. It's very similar. And so what I see, and I know it to be true, is that in the next 5 to 10 years, as I travel a lot and I see the trends around the planet, what used to be a swear word, spin spreaders, is now going to be on every farm of consequence within the next 5 to 10 years. And if it's not physically on the farm, it will be contracted onto the farm.
So that again, Elton Salzberg, kind of sewing it all together, really excellent nutrient management seminar yesterday with the Pattison Agro folks here in Yorkton. And of course, the building itself, the new plant there, is a story unto itself. And we'll get a tour there one day and tell you more about it if you haven't been to visit it. Well, the Western Canadian wheat growers pointing out that since the monopoly of the Canadian Wheat Board went away, there's been some, well, there's been a lot of modernization and change in grain marketing. However, they feel that that's the wheat growers, Western Canadian wheat growers, that their American counterparts are not being treated equally or fairly in this exchange. And in a news release today, the wheat growers say U.S. producers who currently deliver wheat into Canada automatically receive the lowest grade, regardless of the quality or variety of grain, even if the variety is registered in Canada. So the wheat growers and the U.S. Wheat Associates say they're urging the House of Commons here in Canada to open up cross-border wheat trade, and they are saying they're supporting updating the law to ensure wheat is treated consistently on both sides of the border. Obviously, as Canadians, we want to access competitive wheat markets in the U.S., but often this is not the case for U.S. wheat farmers near the Canadian border. So a story to watch and a note out from the wheat growers. Well, also, let's say, on the international trade front, seems like we're talking about that a lot right now with the transition to the Trump administration. Canadian oats is mentioned in a U.S. trade dispute, which likely you would not hear about via CNN or any of the so-called popular media. Someone in the U.S. administration proposed adding a tariff to U.S. oat imports as part of a dispute resolution with the European Union. The U.S. North American Millers Association, NAMA, was asked for comments on a list of products that would be subject to increased import tariffs related to importation of meat and meat products, that is, importing from Europe. Now, for us, the issue is this. Most U.S. imported oats come from Canada, and should there be any interruption in U.S. access to Canadian oats, U.S. millers say they'd be forced to look elsewhere. Sweden and Finland would be likely possibilities. So these comments on the matter from President of the Prairie Oat Growers, Art Enns of Morris, Manitoba.
This is not a new thing, Jack. It's happened twice before where they've had to renew this. Oats has always been included. NAMA has always put up some strong opposition to it, and it's always been excluded in the final print. And we're anticipating no change about it this time. We're expecting the same results over here. Now, we're expecting, will it happen? I guess that remains to be seen. But it's not that it's totally new or has caught us off guard by this piece of, whatever you call it, agreement that comes up for renewal.
So it sounds like it's probably business as usual. What is this? What is the situation these days as far as European oats coming to the U.S. market? I guess every year there's a few boatloads. Has anything changed in that regard?
I don't think it has. We watch our numbers. I mean, it's no secret our numbers have not gotten fully back to what they were before a transportation crisis. And I says Prairie Oak Growers has always been in favor of trade agreements and market access. And you know, in all honesty, our millers in the U.S. still take the largest percentage of oats over here. I think it's still hovering around that 90% mark that they're taking over here. And, you know, the millers need an option should this transportation crisis ever arise again in Canada. They need options, and that's where the Scandinavian or the European oats comes in. They bring it in there. So I think there's always a few boatloads, like you said, coming in every year. I think they kind of want to keep that back door open just in case something happens out here.
I guess we're in a situation where we still don't exactly know what the 2016 crop was because there's still a lot out in the field.
Yeah, there is some out in the field. I think we're getting a better handle on it. You know, obviously it's been down. The pipeline's going to be pretty empty by the end of this year. But so far there's lots of oats around. I think we did have some carryover from the year before. So we're, in talking to our millers, nobody has problems accessing it. You do start, you know, for old crop, you're still seeing some pretty firm prices for old crop. New crop has kind of seemed to have been peaked and has backed off a little bit from the highs over there. And I think that could be a little bit about the rumored higher acres coming in for new crop.
And so as we look at spring, as you and I have discussed, there is talk among farmers of increasing oat acres.
There seems to be a significant increase, at least coffee shop talk right now. But it's not just coffee shop talk. I've talked to a number of seed suppliers, and everybody is seeing a fairly large increase in oat acres that they're seeing in their areas. And it seems to be coming at the expense of wheat, which in the Red River Valley and I think across some of the other areas too, didn't have a good year last year. I know in Saskatchewan was a big disease issue, and here in Manitoba it was the wet conditions and disease also were not making the grade, and oats seemed to kept up there with its yield and its grading factors. So oats has all of a sudden risen to the top as an option out there, and it seems to be coming at the expense of wheat.
That again, Art Enns from Morris, Manitoba, president of the Prairie Oat Growers Association. And the original point of that interview, NAMA, the North American Millers Association, says it strongly opposed the inclusion of tariffs on oats imported from Finland and Sweden in the retaliatory action that was proposed. NAMA said the imposition of trade sanctions against European oat imports would not be practicable or effective and, quote, would cause disproportionate economic harm in U.S. interests, including small or medium-sized business and consumers. So, again, just a lot of trade talk going around these days, and interesting piece earlier from our compatriot Harry Siemens saying that probably that Trans-Pacific Partnership is not dead. Well, we thank you for joining us on the program today, and thank the guys over at Pattison Agriculture. Really great seminar yesterday and great hospitality. We enjoyed it immensely, and lots of good information. By the way, we'll have more about elemental sulfur with Elton Salzberg on an upcoming program. On the Land from The Rock, I'm Jack Dawes.
Thanks for listening to All You Ever Wanted to Know. If you or your organization would like to appear on the program, call Jordan at 306-786-7625. All You Ever Wanted to Know, only on The Rock 98.5.